This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Conference 2022, held at Faith Builders from August 7 to 9.
All right. Well, good afternoon. I almost say good morning. I guess it is now afternoon officially, 12:15. We get the post-lunch session when we're all maybe feeling a little bit sleepy with the little bit of the dreary weather out there. I enjoy this type of weather. This is Educating Gifted Learners. My name is Christopher Brode. I currently live in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. I'm a teacher at Ephraim Mennonite School. I'm the fifth grade teacher there, also involved in a little bit of leadership as well. I get a chance to work with students in grades 3 to 6 this year, and it's always fascinating to interact with that group as they switch from the younger ones in the first and second grade, and then whenever they leave sixth grade and head off into seventh grade. They're all automatically, some of them are usually taller than I am, and carrying some new perspectives and ways of looking at things and ways we can dialogue with them. And I get them right in fifth grade, right in the middle, and where that coming of age experience starts happening, and it's really exciting. I just wanted to get a quick show of hands just to, this topic really could be applicable to anyone, no matter what grades you're teaching. So I'm just curious, if you are in more of an elementary position, would you mind just raising your hand so I could just see who all in here would be more of an elementary? All right, who all is more involved in upper grades, secondary? Thinking like 1 to 6, I'd be thinking of elementary. 7 to 12. All right, so we have a nice cross-section too here, I think, represented in this group. So this is, as I mentioned, the title here is Educating Gifted Learners. This is a field that I've been interested in for a while. I'm currently just finishing up a 2-year course of study on this topic. And when we think of educating gifted learners, the field is probably wide open, and I would stand to think that we're probably bringing a lot of different expectations. Like, what does gifted mean? When we talk about gifted, are there other words that we could use to describe this specific population of students? It was interesting, the statistic that was shared last night. Whenever they polled, I believe it was at college professors, to ask about where they feel they rank themselves, and most of them thought that they were in the above average category. It's been very interesting just to think of the greater context of this breakout session. I couldn't think of a better theme for the weekend as the nurturing humility. And one of the, I feel, unfortunate things that we often think of, and perhaps it leads to some detrimental effects, when we think of our students who, for whom school comes very easy, and we often focus, at least I find for myself, on the middle chunk. We prioritize a lot of our energy for them, and I think that's fitting. And then I feel, especially in the Anabaptist schools that I'm familiar with, we do a very, I would say, commendable job in reaching our students who struggle. I mean, if we look around at a lot of the organizations and the programs and the special schools and community centers and things that we have established to really meet the needs of students who struggle, people who struggle, I would say, more than not just school age. One population I feel sometimes that we might, not intentionally, but I think still and to some degree miss, are those students who come to our classes every day. And oftentimes I feel that we think, you know what, they're going to do fine anyway. Like, they don't struggle. In fact, if anything, this stuff is too easy for them. That allows me to focus on everybody else. And I know I'm there more often perhaps than I should be. But the purpose of this session, I'd like to, as we think about some of the objectives, is help us to be able to see these students a little bit better. And so whenever we, on Monday morning, are standing in front of our classes again and we're looking at the wide range of abilities that we have, we probably have students, as I mentioned, who struggle. We have a lot of students who are perhaps right at grade level, and they're right where you expected that they probably would be. And then if I ask you just to pause and think, you know, what names come to your mind? Which students in your classes this year or in past years, have you found it a challenge yourself to find activities or something that they can be learning that's going to really challenge them? It seems like anytime you have something planned, they're zipped right through it. They're done. And that can create some classroom management troubles as well. What do I do with a student who's always done so early? And so that is another additional aspect of this that I hope that we get a little bit of a chance to talk about. We have about 45 minutes scheduled for just sharing. I have some activities that I hope we can have a few minutes to engage in. And then I'd like to take about 10 minutes at the end that we can just have some discussion together and share, ask questions, and maybe share some experiences. So some objectives. I'd like to start with just taking a few minutes, not nearly the bulk of the time, but just a little bit to identify what are some of the common characteristics of students for whom school comes very easy. They may be called gifted students. In some settings, that's the term that's used. Other times, they're just called advanced students. And sometimes we don't even give them a name. They're just the students who are just, they're just doing what they need to do. And they do it well. And so they allow me to focus on others. But here's where I'd really like to invest most of the time, to look at three strategies that out of all of the different things that we could look at, I think fit the best for us in our setting and the needs that we have. I'm not familiar with many of your situations, but oftentimes we're teaching students from multiple grades in our classrooms. We're teaching students, even if we have one grade in our class, oftentimes the variety is still there that sometimes it might even seem like we're teaching students from several grades. So what are some strategies that we could implement that will help us and facilitate that teaching to the different levels? Because I would just like to preface the rest of what I'd like to share this afternoon by saying that these strategies, while this session is called Educating Gifted Learners, I really see this as effective teaching strategies that anybody can use for any student. So anything that I share here today, keep in mind that these things are for more than just what we would call the gifted or advanced students. These really fit well in any classroom with any student. So I'd like to direct you to your handout and just take a few minutes here. And so if you go down to Roman numeral 2, the question is there in bold, who are gifted students? And I just wanted to give everyone about a minute or 2 minutes. There's a question there for you to jot down what some of your thoughts are, what you're bringing with you right now. It says, when you think of gifted or academically advanced students, what comes to your mind? And so just take a few moments just to, you know, parse through the thoughts that you're having and think here for a moment, you know, who are these students? What comes to my mind when I think of maybe even just the idea of some students being called gifted or advanced? Very good. I feel we can, take a lot of what you shared, and it meets a lot of the points here that I want to talk about here in just the next few minutes. And gifted students defined, so who are they? And thank you for your sharing. I feel like a lot of what I was going to be sharing, you have experience, it sounds like, in your classroom with your students. So I just want to take a few moments to look at who students like this are. And again, I feel like I'm painting with a really broad brush here and making really broad generalizations about a whole population of people, which usually isn't the best thing to do for the purpose of this presentation. I feel that's the route we're going to take, though. So when we think of gifted students, who are they? Generally, we're thinking of students who are above average when in relation to their peers in some aspect, whether that would be math or reading. Occasionally, we encounter students who it's everything. They are advanced in pretty much whatever subject in school that you would give them, perhaps conventional. Sometimes it's not something that is school-related. I have a student this particular year. He struggles immensely academically. Spelling, nigh impossible. Math, attention span is so short, it's very difficult for him to advance. However, if you give him a pile of parts that could be a small engine motor and just let him alone for about 15 minutes, he'll have it up and not only together, but it will be running, like pretty much guaranteed. Ask me, I might be, check on me next year. and I might be just ready to try it out for the first time. But anyway, above average, general, or specific. In some cases, it's very specific. And we could probably, if we think of just who these advanced students are, and we'd like, well, they're probably not, I don't need to do too much for them because, they're just really advanced in math. Well, what can we do for them? High levels of task commitment. And again, this seems a little bit, based on some factors, but generally, again, broad brush, high levels of task commitment, especially if it's something that's interesting, which could be said pretty much of anybody if we're interested in it. Well, we will have varying degrees of task commitment. And this other part, high levels of creativity, which I heard reflected in some of what was shared, learning coming from experience of things that they've already been working with outside of school, and now hey, you're talking about it in class, and this helps. Some students, I had a student last year, he was very interested in some things because he knew it was going to help him with a project of, I forget what it was, I was like, you're working on what? I never would have expected that a 10 or 11 year old would be doing this type of a project, but he wanted to absorb everything that he could because he knew it was going to help him get to the next level with whatever it was that he was doing. Again, this is compared to same age peers. Next, I have who they are not. And I had the word in parentheses always in here because sometimes what's going to be in this next column is true. In fact, it often is. But sometimes I feel like we make this what we're looking for. When we're looking at our students, we're thinking, okay, who would benefit from some additional challenge? And we check off this next list and we're like, well, there's none of the checks here. And so then we just automatically assume, oh, it's just a behavior problem. And maybe, in fact, it's actually an instructional challenge that we could face differently. I have spending more time with learning activities. And so, they're not doing their homework every night. They're not practicing their spelling words. They're not doing their math homework. They're not spending time memorizing this week's Bible memory. They're not doing their schoolwork. They must be struggling academically. Sometimes the real root of that problem is not that they can't, not that they wouldn't spend more time. It's as we heard, what's the point? This is too easy. Which in our rational teacher mind makes no sense, right? It's like, well, if you don't do it, you're going to get a worse grade. But stepping, I think, into the mind of a student for whom this is their experience, it can make a lot of sense, I think. And that connects with the next one. Are we looking for students who school's coming easy just by their report card? Are we looking for straight A's? We can get straight A's for a lot of reasons. And it's not always because the work actually that we've produced actually gets us to an A. Always good behavior. And so oftentimes, well, maybe not often, maybe that word means, that's not the word. But what happens when students get bored? And I'm not saying specifically bored for any reason. Yeah, go ahead. What happens when students get bored?
They start causing behavior issues.
Yeah. I feel like personally a lot of the classroom management struggles that we have are because our students, for whatever reason, get bored. And I know first sometimes I can feel defensive, like, well, they shouldn't be getting bored. Like, so I try to make class interesting. They wouldn't be bored if they would do their work. Or sometimes I feel like we can really try to justify a lot of reasons, or they should learn not to be bored. That's actually one that comes to my mind the most. I'm like, that's a life skill, like how to occupy yourself for sitting at your seat 6.5 hours without getting bored. Maybe we should investigate that sometimes. Maybe what is the reason for that boredom? Is it actually because they might actually need to be challenged a little bit more? And we miss it because we think it's a behavior problem, which I don't want to lessen the fact that it very well could be behavior problems, and I don't want to give a reason or a slip out or a free pass for misbehavior. So I hope that's not what you're hearing me say. But I think as teachers, we do have the responsibility to try to find what the root of those problems are so that we can help our students in whatever way that we can. All right, this thing keeps trying to, and it's succeeding and beating me at my game here by disconnecting my ability to fast forward. Oh, there we go. Some other common characteristics. And again, this is, I think the brush is even getting broader now. These are some other things that maybe as you see them, you think, yeah, you know what? That student who came to my mind earlier, that's them. Something that comes up, and all right, clicker. Maybe I should actually just put this thing down. The first one is perfectionism, which I won't take a raise of hands to find out who all in here. I'll raise my own hand. I know I personally struggle with this one. And this can come, I feel, from a variety of different places. High expectations for self. And what happens when we have those high expectations for others that perhaps are unreasonable expectations? It can cause conflict between people. Have you ever had a paired students together, and one had very, very high ideals of what this project should look like, or this assignment, and the other one's like, nah. Opportunities for interpersonal conflict, I guess. High expectations for self and others, and I think that can come from ourselves, and I think some of that is healthy, to have expectations for the quality of the work that we want to produce. But what happens when that's too high too often? It can, as we heard this morning, it's a recipe for burnout. And we probably could perhaps think of students for whom that has been the case. They're burnt out. The expectations were too high for too long. This also can come from other people. Perhaps you can relate. Straight A's every quarter for years, and then all of a sudden, a child gets a B. Which for some of us would be like, big deal, it's just a B. For a student who has been experiencing this high level of expectation from other people, that can be something to really work through. All of a sudden, those high expectations have been blown, and now it can really throw things into a wreck. Emotionally sensitive, I think sometimes this comes from emotions that have also have developed past perhaps what their peers, where they would be. Our emotions are something that develop through life, and sometimes some of our students might be a little bit further along that line than others. This can lead, and I think this next one can be really beneficial. Students who have a considerable amount of empathy for other people or situations that are happening. Think of students for whom maybe just a read-aloud book. I had an experience like this just a couple years ago that had a situation in it that was, I forget exactly what it was, some sort of a natural disaster. And anyway, it was something that there was a large toll on human life and suffering, and that was extremely difficult for them to take. Even in the form of a read-aloud story, the student was found weeping later. They were just so touched by the situation that it was a difficult that we had to find some time for them to talk and think, well, what is that? They really cared for these people to that extent. Have you ever been doing something in class and you found something funny and only one of your students laughed? I love it when this happens. if that ever happens, check out and see some other things about that student. It may be interested to find out what else is going on. Advanced sense of humor. That happened in my class this year. There was a pretty good pun. I forget what it was. It came out of somewhere. And I heard it, which I try to catch puns. I find lots of joy in life in puns. In fact, I saw this terrible puns back here that I wanted to check out later. But there was one student who had a good knee slap in the back. And I thought that was rather interesting. And this other one, I also catches my attention a lot. This phrase was new to me whenever I started looking into this field a little bit. And this term, twice exceptional. Sometimes, if you read into this idea of academically advanced students, you will encounter this fairly quickly. And that is students who are academically advanced, but you likely don't realize it because it is overshadowed by some other challenge that they have, such as autism. And I will say especially autism. If you have ever had an autistic child or a child with autism in your class, you likely will know that generally, depending on where they are on the spectrum, they usually have their particular field of interest that is of utmost importance to them. Some of you who are in principles of teaching this past year heard me talk about Jimmy. I had a student last year who I'll call Jimmy, who was actually diagnosed with autism throughout the school year. He was intensely interested in history, anything with history, and particularly in ancient history, and especially with the Roman Empire. So I actually have an example of something here that we'll get to a little bit later with Jimmy's name on it. But anyway, students with autism or some other form of a disability, oftentimes, and there's this interesting psychological effect that there's entire teams of researchers figuring out and how some of those disabilities actually lend themselves towards students developing these advanced academic skills as a result of whatever struggle that they have. This thorn in the flesh, so to speak, that one of the side effects of that is an intense interest in things academic. And so, like I said, I want to invest most of the time here and now talking about, so as the teacher, what are some strategies that I can be implementing in my classroom for these students who they are in your class, they will be in your class, and what can we do to help them to reach their potential for whatever it is that God has in mind for them in their lives? You know, where is He leading us? We never really quite, I think back in my times in school, and to think of the idea that someday I would be a teacher, I don't know where you thought you would end up being, but just to think, you know, in the future for our students, where is God leading them, and how can we be equipping them now for whatever that is? And so when we think of these students that we have who have been blessed with these academic giftings, what could be done with that will further the kingdom of God, and how can we help cultivate that now, even now while they're with us? So I want to look at three different strategies that to me are the really the bulk of what we as teachers can be doing. Teachers who have students in a variety of different areas. There are, in some large schools, thinking particularly in the public setting, who have gifted classrooms for like all of the students. And I would love to go into one of these sometime just to watch and see what happens. But generally, that is not the case. We have students representing a variety of abilities and readiness levels. And so, as I was saying, the three strategies I want to share with you are actually the best for any child, specifically for gifted students. The first one is more of an idea than it is an actual strategy that you might implement in your classroom, like, say, cold calling or something like that. And that is the idea of how do you remove the learning ceiling. And so if you look up, there's a ceiling here, and it has a number of purposes. You might think the ceiling, one of the purposes is to keep the weather out. But I would say it also has a purpose of keeping things contained in here. So if it's heat or air conditioning, we try to keep it contained. One of the ways that we do that is we put a ceiling on top and a roof, and then it helps keep all of that conditioned air right in here. And so I want you to think of like the learning that's happening. Imagine instead of air, it's learning. And we put a ceiling on top, and that helps keep things contained to what's in here. But how, when we think of learning and a learning activity that we give our students, I think a lot of times we unintentionally limit how much a student can get out of the activity that we're doing. And so here in a moment, I have an example of an activity. And I hear on your handout and on the bottom of the first page here, it says Roman numeral 3, and this question is there. How can we best engage gifted students in learning? I'm going to show you an activity, and I'd like for you just to pull someone in beside you. I just want to give you like a couple minutes to think of how can I change this activity around a little bit. It doesn't even necessarily have to be a lot. That would allow a student to actually use, they're not going to be limited to learn just the 11 states of the Northeast United States. There, I picked up that clicker again. I shouldn't have done that. So the activity is, it's a map of the U.S., just the Northeast. Students are just supposed to name the states. And so if you think if a child completes this activity, before you actually get started working here, what has said child learned? Go ahead and call out. If someone completes this activity, what did they learn? Yeah, right. They can match location, right? You can identify which state is which, and connect a name with like the outline of that state, and it would turn it in. And this I think could be a very good activity for some students. One of the things someone mentioned earlier was the memorization skills. I made the mistake of giving this assignment to Jimmy, who also loved geography. Well, this was like an insult to his being. Like, are you kidding? As you'll see, the activity back here was actually, he was more interested. He'd mastered this probably when he was like 3. He wanted to know, but what about the ancient Roman provinces? Forget the Northeast. He wanted the good stuff. So how could this activity have been restructured for a student so that gap, that cap on what could be learned, just 11 states in the Northeast. How could we restructure this a little bit so that a student who could go further could. Is that clear? All right, go ahead and think about that for a little bit. Like I said, try to put your heads together and think of some. I think there's a variety of ways. I don't think there's necessarily like a right or wrong answer here. But how could this just be restructured with just a little bit that would allow a student to go a little bit further than this? We'll share some ideas here in about 2 minutes. I know it's not a lot of time, but that's how much time we'll take. All right, what are some of the ways that you came up with, I know in a very limited amount of time, but I think it's actually in some cases it's kind of nice that once you're in the habit, some of these, how you can rearrange things don't actually take that long to come up with. So what are some of the things that you came to your mind or strategies you thought, hey, we could do this, and that would open up that learning ceiling a little bit?
Cut them out, see if they can identify them apart from the whole.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when the state is not, like, surrounded by the others, can you put it back together?
Give them to draw it and label it.
Draw it and label it.
Put more spaces between the blanks and have them write in the capitals and other information about
Yeah. them. So can other information be included other than just a name?
Color in the map with either population density or design it with the state tree or bird or something that goes in each one.
Yeah.
Might need to be a little bigger.
Yeah, might need, yeah.
This would be an extended activity. You give them the opportunity to choose one state and write some paragraphs about it. Context and history.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to mention. We had a quick conversation about this idea of an extension activity where the student does complete this, but then what do they do next? Because there is, I think, some value in a student being able to look at someplace and match correctly. And so this could be a skill to work on that's completely stakes aside. Can you? And Jimmy struggled with that terribly, who was the example I was giving you here, to be able to go back and forth. Anyone else?
Like these extra things that you're giving them, would you tell the whole class to do this paper and then give this one student, just tell him or tell that student, you have to do more? The others feel like they're not as smart, they're not doing as much. Do you quietly tell the student? How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, so how do you go about
these extra things that we're talking about here?
Yes, and so I think that dives into one of the challenges, I guess could be a word, of this, is how do you present some of these activities to the class in a way that for the students who maybe would just struggle just to do this, to just write, you have some students who are working on that than others who are doing the others.
Like for myself, when I get writing assignments, I expect more out of some than others.
Yeah.
And that's something that just grading, I'll grade them harder on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they know that.
Yeah.
It's just because I know that they do a better job at it or whatever. But like something like this, you'd almost need to attach it to that paper or something.
Yeah. Or even I think there's a variety of ways of doing it. Supposing it as an extension activity where you complete this and then you go on to the next thing when you're done.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you just had, I don't know, just one way that comes to my mind is those additional instructions or whatever they are, just on a piece of paper that students grab whenever they're finished.
Okay.
And then students know that that's perhaps not the requirement that that's completed.
And you might have some that is intentionally go slow.
So well, then you would. You absolutely would.
I can name the ones who would do it.
Another way of doing this is, and this I think gets more down here to this strategy 3, this independent learning, and one of the methods of doing that is giving some students a couple options, and maybe one of the options is something that's going to be for the students who you know will work, who need to put a fair amount of energy into this, and then some instructions then for those who are in that middle category, and then some for those who are perhaps advanced in geography, who already know these states. I think that question is going to actually be a theme that's going to run throughout a lot of a lot of the other strategies that we're going to share here is, how do you approach this? I think sometimes we try to give an impression that everybody has to be doing the same thing, and that, you know, that if a student is sitting at their desk and they look over and another student is doing something completely different, you know, what does that feel like for that student? Do they get the message that I'm not advanced enough to do that, or the teacher didn't think that I was capable of doing that? You know, what message does that just give? And how can we preempt that so that we can minimize the impact of that? Strategy two. It's called the tiered lesson, which may be more of just a specific way of removing the learning ceiling in some ways, but this would be a way of planning, a method of planning, lesson planning that helps streamline this idea of how can we take an assignment such as this map activity from earlier and make it so that students can be doing a variety of different things that will help, that will more meet wherever they are. They allow you as the teacher to plan one single activity. So like I said, maybe it's the map activity. I have an example in here that's a math example with math facts and solving some addition problems with regrouping. While in it, providing a way that you as the teacher have planned ahead of time that will provide an avenue or a route for some students to work at a more advanced level. And also then another avenue, if needs be, for students who are perhaps struggling a little bit and need some additional support. And this last bullet point is something I think I need to stress for myself. It can be easy to say, oh, they're done, and so now I'm going to give them more work to do. And so what actually can end up happening is it almost in some ways feels like a punishment. You know, you mastered this, you know, you knew the names of the states when, you know, years ago, and so now I'm going to ask you to do a whole bunch of extra additional work while the rest of the class is spelling out the names of the states. So how can we make sure that it's not students doing more, but perhaps just something that is more appropriate to the challenge level, rather than, you know, extra worksheets or extra memorization? And so I want to draw your attention to, if you go back to the next page of your handout, it says tiered lesson plan template. The front side is completely blank. I'd like for you to actually flip to the back side of it. And some of it is filled out. You'll know you're there. It says key concept objectives. Students will be able to apply the concept of regrouping while adding whole numbers. I want you to imagine a lesson where that's what you're teaching a class. They have just a few add-ins, and they need to add them together. And when they're in the ones column, they're going to get a number more than 10. They need to carry the 1 or 2 or whatever the number might be. As teachers, we often have some idea of where our students already are based off of what they've already done for us. In this case, you may have given a math facts timed quiz or something, then you have a fairly good idea of about what math facts this child has mastered, whether they know their addition facts, how many of them they know, how quickly they can answer them. I added another thought. Perhaps you even went as far as giving them just a few of these questions to see who in here already knows how to do them. Do I have any students who maybe they learned this last year and they've remembered it from before? Or maybe they learned it outside of school because an older brother or sister had learned it, and I've been amazed at what some students can learn just because an older brother or sister has learned it before. For whatever reason, I don't know, it could be anything, that they already know this. So what are you going to do? So you have a whole group introduction lesson. Perhaps everybody gets this. You use the base 10 blocks or whatever method that comes to your mind of how do you teach students to regroup. Maybe you do a couple practice problems all together somehow or on paper. I like to use little mini whiteboards that students can write on and erase. And now you want students to practice this. They're going to practice adding numbers and regrouping. So the purpose of this tiered lesson plan template is how can you provide, and you don't have to use all three. There's room here for three. Once you get more than three, so I think it often gets kind of stressful on the teacher to come up with a whole bunch of different things. And so I would recommend not going beyond this. Sometimes just two, and there's times when it's one. In fact, there's oftentimes like we're all doing the same thing. We're all doing this today. But how could we provide a couple of different ways that students could practice this based off of how well they already know this skill, if they know it at all? So tier one, tier two, tier three. So right away, if you were going to think, okay, what activity would I give to see if students could do this? We're going to practice. Think in terms, how could I make this activity a little bit more challenging? Or a little bit less challenging? What part of the assignment could you tweak? Any ideas?
Have one of the students do the base 10 blocks for everyone else to see. That way I often don't think about things the way my students do. Huh. So then I can stand back and think about it the way they think about it as they're explaining it to their classmates.
Yeah. So they could have the addition of the concrete application. Maybe some students who are struggling to make that connection to the concrete, to the abstract. Regrouping is very abstract a lot of times, and that's an area where some students can really struggle. Especially, I think sometimes we tend to try to teach it before students are really capable of thinking abstractly. How else could you change it? I hate to write on this blackboard. It's so clean. Let's say you had problems like this on your standard practice sheet. How could you up the challenge level for students who can already solve problems like this?
During my practice, I'm not sure if you're asking about during the practice problem time, like when we're all on the mini whiteboards, or are you talking about more specifically like any time in the lesson, like maybe later?
Thinking more like later on in the independent practice. So you've done the whole class activity.
You already did that.
You've already done that. So now students are going to practice now. Mm-hmm. And we want them to be practicing at a level that's, you know, that zone of where it's actually going to be
right.
Meaningful to them.
Because right. Even in the practice problem time, it can be hard to keep everybody engaged.
Yes, so. It can.
Mm-hmm. So the idea in my mind, I'll just share it since I started talking anyway, is that you could have, you know, all the students would complete three problems, and you could have an extra challenge problem. And then beyond that, if you got all those done, you could make up a story problem with your own numbers. Mm. And we'd like to see if you can, and that as a teacher, I would look for, did they actually pick two add-ins that do actually require repeating?
Yeah.
And you could, okay, that's a once in a while idea, but.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that would be a great example.
I'm talking about tiering more in the practice problem section, though, not in.
Yeah. I think the part of the wonder of it is that we can apply it anywhere we want to. Yeah.
Students who like to challenge in math are often like, so what if there's six digits in that number?
Yes. Some students, if you give them the two, they're like, oh. As soon as you give them this, like, all right, and they get to work.
Sometimes I'll tell them to see how many they can get done in a certain amount of time.
Mm. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think it's a great way of sort of tiering it.
You could have the ones that finished your assignment find a friend that's still struggling with it and help them when they have to explain it.
Yeah.
It's an added challenge.
Yeah. That's really good. Anybody else?
Have them carry them mentally rather than making them work.
Love that. That's a great idea. My students try to do it anyway. You know, like, show your work kind of challenge, but like, I want you to do it now without showing your work. I don't know if you can do that. I get to see that, like, watch me.
How about adding from the left to the right?
Oh. Yeah, well.
We have some students who, you know, 200,000. You know, the two there means 200,000, and three
2 means 200,000, the 3 equals 300,000, and then just break it down. Yeah, I've had students who messed with it in those ways.
Yes, I had one this past week who did that. We had a problem that was just like this. It gave the most of them, and it had a blank here. And they thought it must be, I think they just put a number in here, and it was wrong. I could figure out, what? Why is that wrong? Without thinking, well, you're going from left to right, and you didn't think, well, over here there was actually another one already, and this is actually supposed to be a 2. And then I was like, I saw the light bulb click on, I'm like, oh yeah. The place value is coming for, it's both ways. It, like, you don't just always go from one direction, you can go both ways. I like that.
I think I've seen students write Roman numerals as well.
Wow. Like for each digit?
Yes. Or maybe for the answer.
Jimmy loved Roman numerals. It's mentioned. Let's move on to the third strategy. And this one, I guess one of the, I think, just guiding principles of any of these things, it's really when it comes down to it, is what's going to work best for whoever is the student is who you're thinking of, or that particular lesson. If it's, rather than giving a couple of tiers for the independent practice, maybe it is, if it fits for that lesson, how you're going to maybe tier the other parts of the instruction as well, the practice problems. What about times where, and again, I'm going to bring up Jimmy as the example, the entire unit, they already know it. I know sometimes it's easy for me to justify, it's like, well, anything worth learning once is worth learning again. Usually I sometimes feel like that's a little bit of a cop-out on my end, especially if I'm not feeling like I have much time, extra time on hand that I can invest in designing or creating something else. And that, here, this brings into this the idea of what can it look like for a student to learn independently. This is something we always do to some extent already, building independence. How well can they work alone? I think this can, I will say, well, with most things in education can be overdone as well. Just giving a student entirely free rein just to choose anything can be a bit much for a student. But to be able to sit down with them sometime, especially if you know, say they already know their 50 states. They know them. They could tell you their capitals. They could tell you everything you wanted to know about them. They could give you the region. Jimmy, he could. He could even tell me what state they were added to the union. He could tell me anything you wanted to know about them. He could already say. He probably could name you the current governor, and I don't know. I mean, it was very difficult to come up with a way that I could challenge him. Like, there's no point in doing this. So, what can we do instead? While we're doing this, Jimmy, what can you be doing? He was also a student who expressed behavior problems whenever he was bored. It usually came in the form of calling out really loudly and getting angry about things. So anyway, that's an extreme example, but how can we have students occupied in a constructive way? I think it's important that we have a plan for students who have already mastered the content. There may be times, and I I'm not saying that we should never, ever require a student to learn something again, even if they already know it, because I think there is value in being able to do that. I can think of a number of things that we've heard over and over again that are new every time. I think there's value in that. But for cases like I'm mentioning, what do we do about that? What can we do? I have an example of one way that I have found that works nicely with keeping students accountable to something. If you just send a child back there and go learn something about the states, I know you know a lot already, just go back and learn something new. That doesn't really provide much structure or accountability of any sort. And also, then when it comes time for you, you need a grade for that child. What are you gonna do? Where are you gonna pull a grade from? And so I have an example of something that's called a learning contract. It kind of sounds very official. And in ways it's meant to provide that sort of formal accountability to a student. It also allows for them to bring some of their own. So what are you interested in? What part of geography? Do you have any goals of what you would like to learn? And I built this learning contract here based off of Jimmy's response. So if you wouldn't mind going to the last page of this three-page document. Again, the front side is a blank template of what you could fill in. And then the back is one that, just in this case, it's completed there for you. So this is one. So what's the overall goal of his learning? So this was for Jimmy last year. He would like to learn the names and the locations of the provinces of the Roman Empire. And he was interested in how, if any way, are they connected to the modern boundaries that we see in Europe and Northern Africa and Asia Minor. I'm like, whoa, is this coming from an 11-year-old? But that's what he wanted to learn. He was fascinated. I was first alerted to this whenever he could not take it anymore. He had to let me know that he had just found the absolute best map of the Roman provinces he had ever seen in his life. This was in the middle of a math class. I was like, wait a minute, why are you not doing your math assignment, first of all? And second of all, like, where did you find this? And he was the first one, I think, I've been teaching, that was my 10th year of teaching, the first person who had ever picked up this book from my library. I almost had gotten rid of it because no one wanted it. It was on the book on the Romans. He had probably read it word for word several times. And then he was just so excited that this map was there. And so you want to learn, you know, what is there benefit to that now? Hey, it can't hurt, sure. You know everything that we're doing now. Maybe it's something else. This is just an example. What concepts will I learn? So what are you going to learn about this as you're going through? Are there any big concepts, big ideas that, you know, how is this going to be helpful to you? Here's some other, and this is a conversation that you can have if you have time. You can direct as the teacher with the big picture in mind and knowing, you know, what the route is that we'd like to take with this. Again, reinforcing the names of the modern boundaries and names of states, nation states. How have they changed? And so even the borders that we see in this part of the world today are different than they were, say, pre-World War II, or even in some cases even after that. How did the Roman Empire expand? Where did it start? Which directions did it expand? Why did it go this way, not that way? Was it bigger? How did it flux? Was it always that big? Did it get smaller? All sorts of things to investigate here. And then this part, very fascinating, he was interested in learning Latin. I think he was taking Latin courses at home. Looking at place names, what looks familiar to you, and why might that be? What's the root of the names of some of these modern countries? And are any of them based on some old Latin words? And if not, where do they come from? All sorts of things. I mean, this was amazing. We did not accomplish all of this. So if you're thinking like, whoa, but these were some lofty goals, and he did fairly well. So what type of a project will this be? So this, again, is meant to be something that you can be working with the rest of the class, with the standard curriculum, what it is that you use, while, you know, student X, Y, or Z is pleasantly occupied and thrilled over what they're learning back there, so that you're more free to work with the students who really need to learn the core content. Here, it's a detailed hand-drawn map that was going to be posted on somewhere in the classroom where the other students could see and see what so-and-so was working on. And I think this has a nice added benefit that they're able to then also make some connections and perhaps develop some of their own interests. We've ever seen things that, for better or for worse, that one student is interested in and often has a way of spreading to other people. And so having some way that, if possible, it doesn't always have to be this way, that student then would have an opportunity to share what they've learned. And then this last part is then very helpful then to you. One question often comes up, well, how do you grade something like that? I mean, do I just put his name in my grade book with just him? And no one else has that grade, like, what do I do? Grades can be calculated to do that. Or maybe it's you replace his grade for something else with this one. Anyway, this is what the basis for his project was going to be, based off of, you know, what you would expect: accuracy, neatness, attractiveness. Is it colorful? Does it look nice? And then providing some accountability, too, as far as getting it completed. And so here, again, losing a point, perhaps, if the project is finished late. And student, sort of formally signs their name down here. It's a contract, after all. Sort of an understanding then between you and the student. Then you just find some time just to check in with them. Maybe while you have everybody else dutifully working on their state map, you just go back and check on Jimmy and see how he's doing. We do have a few minutes left. Not nearly as much time as I was hoping to have. We do have a little bit of time left for, if anybody has any questions or anything that experiences that you've had or anything you'd like to share for the value of the group, let's take a little bit of time here to do that.
Have you seen any statistics, maybe as part of your master's degree, where percentage of students that would be in the category of having some kind of exceptional learning challenge versus percentage of students who are exceptionally gifted? So if you had 100 students in a room, how many of those could we expect on average to have to be a gifted learner?
Yeah, there are statistics out there that people guess, or not guess. Maybe there's a little bit of to that, but 6 to 10% usually you can find. I've seen the number as high as 15%. Yeah. So if a room of 100 people, anywhere between 6 to 15. Unlike what is it, 95 that we heard earlier. So probably I was wondering if it was the 5 who didn't say anything are actually the ones who knew to keep their mouth shut. I don't know.
Or does it, well, I think what I'm hearing you describe is more than just IQ. But.
Yeah. This is, as far as like a field of education that people have been, like been intentionally focused on, it's about, say in the past 100 years or so, people have really tried to nail down exactly some of these measurements and metrics. And it varies. At one point in time, it was IQ of 130 or above is probably going to, they're likely going to be these students. But generally what we find is IQ is not a very good measurement for this.
It keeps rising, doesn't it?
It keeps, it rises. There's this idea now, I mean, of like fixed mindset versus growth mindset. I mean, are you stuck with the same IQ that you had from whenever you were, you know, 2 or 3, or is it something that can change? And it would be very, very hard to find, like even in like schools that would have a gifted program, so to speak, which many of them out there, have mostly scrapped the idea of it's IQ or nothing. That there's so much more to this.
But they probably include that.
That's often included as one of the things to look for. Mm-hmm. Most schools will also even make, like, if it's above this, like, even if there is nothing else, like, chances are they need some sort of support because, you know, there's often going to be other struggles there as well. Different schools have tried, and teachers have tried various assessments other than an IQ test, achievement tests, and other sorts. But again, it's just like a small picture. What actually has been shown to be the most beneficial, helpful way of identifying, if that's the word you want to use, this type of student is teacher intuition. What are you picking up on as the teacher? One of the things I would try to do, first of all, is to see like what they're racing to get their work done so that they do what? Is there something that they're trying to do afterwards?
Free time.
Free time, yeah. So is it like completely unstructured free time, or is there options of what they have? The reason why I'm asking is I've had students in the past who were very advanced in math, and they knew whenever they finished that they could go work on all of the advanced Rubik's cubes that I had in the corner. And so their work was atrocious. It was turned in. But then they were over there solving Rubik's cubes. I tell you what, I don't know how anybody ever solves. I would look and see what.
There are, so free time for them would be like on the library.
Okay.
Or drawing together with my friends in a corner, or helping out in other classrooms.
Mm.
It's basically the focus is my work is hindering me from doing something different.
Yeah. I wonder if there can be a way that you could even set like a baseline, like this is the quality of work that I'm expecting. That when you produce this type of work, then you can do whatever that is. I wonder if sometimes if some students need a visual of what you're actually expecting them to do. Especially, I've noticed this for some of my students. To them, done is done. Like it doesn't matter what it looks like. Or they may give the impression that they think that. I'm not sure, but. Either way, I wonder if sometimes just having a visual of this is what's done. And maybe if they are, say, advanced in math, maybe one of the tiers is rather than doing all of them, do they have to practice all of them if they already know it? And so maybe that's just deciding ahead of time, like what is considered done here, rather than letting them decide what it is.
And then you have the opposite end of that where your student is like really smart, but they go so slow and everything has to be perfect.
Because they might get it wrong.
Well, that's just how neat it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking more of how neat it is. And so they spend way too much time on things, and then they have homework every single day.
Mm.
But their work is perfect.
Yeah. That's one of the things I have found can lend itself, can be the highway to that burnout
mm-hmm.
and the perfectionism, because it starts taking the time of things that they would need to otherwise recharge. Yeah. In that case, I wonder sometimes if it's just limiting, and then also finding a way to relieve them from that burden,
mm-hmm.
Which I, as a recovering perfectionist myself, is easier said than done. All right, why don't we, I believe, according to the clock, I could keep here talking about this. I enjoy talking about this topic. I feel the responsible thing to do with the people will let you go if you need to go. Why don't we just close with prayer, and then, if you'd like to hang around for a little while, I plan to make myself available. I do have a couple of resources over here. I did mention some of them in the back of the handout. If you're ever interested and want to do some more reading and research into it, you're more than welcome to find us. There's lots of resources out there in this field of people who have some really good recommendations and many, many different approaches for how you can address some of the struggles that you might have with students who are just advanced. Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we just thank you for first just who you are. Thank you for the relationship that we can have with you and how that brings many things into alignment when we are able to just be thankful to you, Lord, that what are we, that you were mindful of us as these creatures made of dirt. Help us, Lord, as we teach our students, as we interact with the many individuals that you have placed in our care, students who represent a variety of different abilities within different subjects, and we know that you have a special purpose in mind for each one, and we just pray, Lord, that you would help us as we have just a small amount of time, really, as we think about all of what life could be in the many years of development and learning and growth. Help us, Lord, as we seek to best teach our students wherever they may be. I just pray that you would give us wisdom and guidance. Yes, this in Jesus' name. Amen.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769. Recordings from past events are also available at www.thedocforlearning.com.